And so with that, we will call to order the meeting of the House Early Childhood Finance and Policy Division. My apologies, we're starting a few minutes late. Let's start with the clerk taking the roll.
Representative Pinto, Chair.
Present.
Representative Katizawatun, Vice Chair.
Present.
Representative Franson. Representative Bonner. Representative Damath.
Present.
Representative Heitzman.
I'm here.
Representative Morrison.
Present.
Representative Pryor.
Present.
Representative Wasilek.
Present.
Representative West.
And so we do have a quorum. We have our minutes before us. My understanding is that there is a technical correction to the minutes in the spelling of the name of Caitlin Snyder. So with that correction to her name, may I have a motion to approve the minutes?
So moved.
And so Representative Morrison moves approval of the minutes. Any additions or corrections beyond the one I mentioned? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Anybody opposed? And hearing none, the minutes are approved. So members, we are continuing through our review of and our presentations on early childhood programs. You remember that on Tuesday we heard from Department of Human Services and last Thursday Department of Education, and today again is some more information from the Department of Education. I want to make sure to point your attention, members and audience, to the information that House Research had put together on early learning programs, which contains a really nice summary of various programs. It gets kind of confusing because we're talking about a couple different departments, and so it's nice to have them all listed in one place. With that, we are going to continue then with the Department of Education's presentations, and so we'll call up our presenters from MDE. And so if you can state your names for the record, whoever's going first at least, and then feel free to begin your presentation. And I might ask as you begin, you let us know if you don't mind. It seems like we've been mostly asking questions in the course of presentations, if that's okay, at least clarifying questions. Then, of course, we can ask bigger questions at the end as well, if that's okay with you. But please begin.
Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you. My name is Bobby Burnham. I am the director of the Division of Early Learning Services at the Department of Education. And Mike Brown is with me to help cover the numerous early childhood programs that MDE implements.
Okay, please begin.
Thank you. Today we are going to continue with our overview of several of the programs that Department of Ed implements. Again, as you saw last week, the Department of Education is committed to these 10 commitments of equity. And so we are working to embed those in all the work that we do. I also talked last week about how our work at the Department of Ed is really focused on a birth through age 8 learning continuum. This visual gives you an idea of the programs represented across the state agencies that we all collaborate to implement. Those include early childhood programs of home visiting, early intervention, early Head Start, both public and private child care, and then moving into the age 3 to 5 categories of public pre-K, Head Start, early childhood special education, again, child care, community-based preschools, and then into the early elementary years with full-day kindergarten with grades 1 through 3 and the addition of the before and after and summer school program. So we really focus on the whole child with these programs and family and community support, as well as parent education and focusing on the mental and emotional and physical health of the families. The programs we will give an overview of today include the Early Childhood Indicators of Progress, otherwise known as the ESIPs, School Readiness, Early Childhood Family Education, Early Childhood Health and Developmental Screening in the Kindergarten Entry Profile. I was very excited that you had asked to hear about the Early Childhood Indicators of Progress. I think that's a first in my 10 years in this position, so it's really nice that you have interest in the Early Childhood Standards. And as I mentioned last week, we had a Race to the Top grant, and through that grant, we were able to take the time to revise our Early Childhood Indicators of Progress. through that revision process, we had 8 committees of 120-plus teachers, directors, researchers, coaches, trainers, and higher ed faculty that participated in this revision process. So it was a very thorough research-based process. And it's important to note that it's a continuum of increasingly complex learning for children birth through age, through kindergarten entrance. And I brought a nice bound copy for all of you of the ESIPs. I think as we talk through those today, it'll be helpful for you to actually see them. Again, the ESIPs were an effort to build coherence for both the children and for adults. So you can see by this visual that the ESIPs serve as the core for the guidance that adults use in their planning their learning activities, as well as the core for all different early learning program types, including childcare, school-based, Head Start, and early childhood special education. So that coherence piece, again, is really important and has been very intentional work of the department. So the ESIPs define what all children are expected to know and be able to do, not how teachers should teach. So for instance, play-based learning is a priority in all of our early learning programs with young children. Play-based learning with young children is not specified by the ESIP, so you're not going to see a play-based learning standard in there. So a good way to think about this is that the standard is the what, and the play-based learning is an instructional strategy, so it's the how of the standards should be implemented. So play-based learning is a teaching strategy, and all teachers really have their own style of teaching and will teach according to what the individual child needs. So play-based learning is the how of implementing the what, which is the standards. This chart shows you the different learning domains of the ESIPs. And they are, there's the content areas of the ESIPs. The 3 areas that are in bold are in addition to the kindergarten academic standards. They are physical development, social and emotional development, and approaches to learning. So the approaches to learning is more focused on how you learn to learn. So it's managing your own learning, focusing on the traits such as curiosity, engagement, persistence, inventiveness, organizing your own information. And emotional development is building the traits of trust, attachment, relationship building, self and emotional awareness, and self-management.
Ms. Burnham, can you go back to the prior slide? Can you just clarify again the bold versus not bold? I guess I found that kind of confusing.
So, Mr. Chair, thank you. The 3 bold are in addition to the K-12 standards. So the K-12 standards do not include social and emotional approaches to learning and physical and movement development.
And so, Ms. Burnham, if I'm understanding you right, then the K-12 standards include those other 5 areas then?
Correct,
okay.
Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. Please continue.
This chart is just another visual showing the alignment between, it demonstrates the alignment of the ESIPs to the academic standards. These are the sub-components of the language and literacy strand, and you can see how they are visualized in the academic standards for English language arts. The way the standards are displayed, which you can see in the hardbound copy provided to you in the core document, supports the planning of teachers across age ranges, and especially given the unpredictability of child development, it's important to know what these age expectations are prior to a certain age and beyond a certain age. So the way this document is laid out has been very useful and helpful to all teachers of all ages, because it gives them kind of a before and after look at age expectations. We have several resources available through the department's website. Part of the Race to the Top effort, too, was to develop what we call practice briefs for teachers and coaches. So these are documents that teachers and coaches use to help implement and align the standards to whatever curriculum that they're implementing. We also develop parent guides for the Minnesota Early Learning Standards, available in 6 languages. And the booklet version, which you have today, is also available online. With that, if there's not any questions, I'm going to turn it over to Mike Brown, and he will go through early childhood family education as well as school readiness.
And Ms. Burnham, I actually am going to ask one other question, which is back on slide 8. Can you just talk a little more about, or just clarify how the ESIPs are actually, like practically speaking, how are they actually used in these areas of child care, ECSE, early child special education, Head Start? I mean, practically speaking, where are they actually being used, or how's that actually working?
Mr. Chair, great question. So when the ESIPs were revised, you know, we work across agency as well as across organizations such as Head Start and the Early Child Care or the Child Care Association. Everyone has agreed to use this set of standards as their core set of early childhood indicators of progress. So the state, no matter what program type you are, is using this one set of standards in the implementation of their program. So any curriculum that they choose, any assessments that they choose, we work with them and encourage them to align their instructional practice to this set of core standards.
Ms. Burnham, do you have a sense as to how much, how often they are in fact being used in those settings? It sounds like it's more sort of an encouragement. I mean, it's how widespread are these standards in those areas?
Please. Mr. Chair, thank you. So we don't have data that shows that. When we are out doing technical assistance and professional learning, there's pockets that use it very intentionally, and there are pockets of the state who aren't even aware they exist. So it's very sporadic. We know that Head Start programs, parent-aware rated programs, voluntary pre-K, school readiness programs all are required to align their work to the ESIPs. But could there be more intentional work to spread this document throughout the state and get it in the hands of many different types of child care providers? We actually got the hardbound copies from Child Care Aware, and of course they contract with Department of Human Services with all their Parent Aware rated programs, so it is becoming more and more widely used, but there's still a ways to go.
Okay. And Representative Pryor had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just on that same line of understanding, Can you review a little bit like the time frames when you said that they were first developed, and then you said just recently they've been realigned additional work has been done. So when did we start, and when did we revisit it?
Ms. Burnham.
Mr. Chair, thank you for the question. As part of the Race to the Top, they were revised from the years 2011 to 2015. I believe they were first published in 2007, so they were in need of revision. And we also there was 2 sets of documents. There was 1 document for birth to 3, and there was 1 document for 3 to 5, and we took those and created this 1 document for birth to kindergarten entrance.
Okay. Representative Pryor.
And another question, also trying to understand how they're disseminated and used. Are they part of a curriculum when there are certificate degrees and in our higher ed institutions?
Ms. Burnham.
Mr. Chair, that is a really good question. We, again, we can only require them when we have the opportunity to embed them in a statute such as voluntary pre-K or parent aware. The ESIPs are not a curriculum, so different programs choose their own curriculum and are encouraged to align their curriculum with the ESIPs. So that's a different time-consuming process, but we encourage their use to the degree of authority we have. So given that, you know, many school districts are local control. They choose their own curriculum. Everyone chooses their own curriculum, but we do work closely with Parent Aware. And one of the goals moving forward is to continue working with DHS and Parent Aware programs to ensure that the menu of curriculums and the menu of assessments that are on the approved Parent Aware list are more and more aligned to these ESIPs.
Okay, thank you. Any further questions from anybody on the ESIPs? And seeing none, please continue.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Mike Brown. I work at the Minnesota Department of Education. Two of the programs I work with there are ECFE, Early Childhood Family Education, and School Readiness. So ECFE, I guess Early Childhood Family Education, more commonly known as ECFE, is a parenting education program designed to support children's learning and development. To be eligible, it's children birth to kindergarten entrance. The program also may serve expectant parents. And if the district has a pre-K to grade 3 initiative, they can serve parents up to third grade. So in total, the program may serve children prenatal and their families up to third grade. Our latest numbers on children served in the program are just over 20,000. I didn't have the latest on the parents, but historically every year we're within 2,000 of that number, either 2,000 more parents or 2,000 less, depending on the class type. So there will be more parents because some programs offer parenting-only classes. But in the classes that are ongoing that meet more than six times as a group, then there will be more children, of course, because families oftentimes have more children than they have parents. And the program, other relatives or care providers may attend with the child. Funding-wise, we're just above 30 million state funds that go into ECFE that support the program. Currently, it's about $145 per child, so funding is based on the birth to five census in a district area. There is a minimum of 150, so a smaller community like Red Lake Falls, they will have about $21,000 in ECFE funds. Couple of the key components I'll go into more in depth as we go into it. The outcome measures on this are just participation numbers that we collect. There's also a community needs assessment requirement in the program, and I'll address that further.
Mr. Brown, can you give us a sense as to the geographic and demographic aspects of those numbers? I mean, where in the state are kids being served, and what information do we have about the kind of families or the kind of kids who are participating in the program?
Mr. Chair, so we ECFE is run through school districts. All Minnesota school districts, with the exception of three, there's three school districts currently that do not have an ECFE program. The reason for that is a shortage of licensed parent educators that they cannot find. We do collect demographics, and that will vary, of course, district by district. In general, statewide, ECFE serves a representative sample of Minnesota's population. Some districts, like St. Paul School District, will serve a higher percentage of at-risk students, so they have more families that will meet income, higher or lower income requirements. So it'll vary depending on the district.
You may be addressing this sort of the outreach later, but I was struck in an earlier presentation that almost half of all births are to moms on medical assistance, and so it's, you know, a pretty high poverty proportion. Just wondering about district outreach to make sure that very low income families are are being made aware of this? And then, again, you may be addressing that in a future slide, but if not, if you can just talk about that in terms of making sure that the families are aware of this, since such a high proportion are, in fact, quite low income.
Mr. Chair, I think I will be addressing it in a future slide.
All right, thank you.
The current slide here lists the key program requirements of ECFE. So as it is a program that focuses on parenting education, it also has a very strong early childhood component. So ECFE is one of our programs that requires both licensed early childhood teachers and licensed parenting educators. The traditional ECFE class will be 90 minutes to 2 hours in length. So parents and children come together. The classroom, the early childhood classroom, will be set up to promote parent-child interaction. So there will be a variety of activities for parents and children to do together. About halfway through the class, there will be some type of transition activity where the entire class meets parents and children, and then the parents separate, and then they will have 45 minutes to an hour for parent discussion time that's facilitated by that licensed parent educator. Meanwhile, the children will be in a classroom. Again, the activities there are designed to facilitate peer-to-peer interaction amongst the children, engage them in various learning activities. One of the more recent changes to ECFE statutes was the requirement for programs to conduct a community needs assessment. In this community needs assessment, programs are required to do this each year. They're required to identify new and underserved populations, identify child and family risk factors, particularly those that impact children's learning and development, and then assess parenting and family education needs in the community. One of the things when this came out was we debated how we would collect information from districts regarding this report. It would be most easy for us to somehow collect quantitative data from their needs assessment. We found this just too cumbersome and limiting. So each year districts submit a narrative report to us where they respond to how they collected the information and what their results were. And we tabulate that each year, and I will share some information on that a couple slides later. So ECFE, one of the strengths is that it should be tailored to meet local needs of the community. So with the needs assessment, districts are supposed to develop programming that's tailored to meet the needs of families identified or prioritized in the needs assessment. It also expands the opportunities that districts have to provide programming and services to families, that they can do that to anybody identified in the needs assessment. So, for instance, if a district identified that there were a lot of child care providers who were expressing a need to learn more about family engagement or interacting with families or corresponding with them about their child's development, that would be one area where ECFE could provide support. ECFE can also provide parenting education now up to third grade. So this provides districts an opportunity to work with families through those critical transition years through the grade levels, as well as work with districts or schools or wherever children are with their early elementary teachers. The other thing is that ECFE law encourages ECFE programs to provide a liaison to community partners, so including Head Start, child care, health care, wherever children may be in that birth to, or really prenatal to grade 3 continuum. So to just to go back to the needs assessment, this is just an example of some of the results. So especially in early childhood, we're kind of used to seeing kind of one risk factor being a child's income as determining risk. The needs assessment asked for child and family risk factors. So communities in their needs assessment, this is an example here of some of the things that they identified, which greatly expands it. And in the vast majority of cases, you know, the risk comes in the family and is seen in the family well before it's identified in the child. So these may be instances with, for instance, incarceration, domestic violence, job loss, deployment. So districts came up with a number of areas that they see in the in families in their community that may put a child at risk for future learning struggles or struggles with school. ECFE also supports other district early childhood programs. So just a sampling here, early childhood screening. ECFE must provide information about the program and, if needed, assist in making arrangements for early childhood health and developmental screening. School readiness, one of the requirements of school readiness that I'll be talking about later is involving parents in program planning and decision making. ECFE is required to have a parent advisory council that's made up of parents that represent the community. Most districts also include school readiness information or goals in their early childhood advisory council, so there's an overlap. And then in voluntary pre-kindergarten statutes, also includes language about aligning and being responsive to activities in alignment with ECFE.
Mr. Brown, I think Representative Pryor has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the last slide, slide 19, the risk factors, just looking through the list, some of the risk factors are identified. They're very objective. You can count how many people in the family if somebody's on military deployment. But some of them seem to be more subjective to assess, like poor parenting skills. So who does that part of it, and how are those less objective risk factors identified?
Mr. Brown.
Mr. Chair, thank you for the question. So these are developed locally. We, when designing the needs assessment, so statutes just said that districts must complete a needs assessment every year. We gave programs kind of wide latitude in how they wanted to conduct their needs assessment, in the sense that do they want to just focus on these three questions, or do they want to do a more comprehensive needs assessment? And then the things that, so we didn't put a lot of limits on what they could identify as those. Our guidance on that was either to go to research to select what they what are known child and family risk factors and list those, or they could interview or work with other community members or parents in the community to have those listed. So I think exactly what you're saying is correct. Some are going to be solidified and backed up by research, and some are more objective.
Please continue.
So one of the ways that we're providing more support and really in alignment with a movement with ECFE traditionally being a very responsive program to families, in the sense that it's really common for their classes to be in a community education brochure. Parents will have to find what those classes are. Sometimes that can be limiting because it would take a more sophisticated or intentional parent to have to look through these classes to find out what may be offered. So schools have been doing a lot more outreach to help recruit or find or inform parents about what ECFE is and what they offer. I know St. Paul School District, for instance, uses cultural liaisons to connect communities, the various communities that they serve with their ECFE program. For us at the state, for the last 5 years, we've been offering a parenting education symposium or a family engagement institute. It varies each year, but the Parent Ed Symposium in the last couple of years especially has focused on some of those high need, high risk areas. Last year we had incarceration as one of our themes, and then this year it focused on homelessness. And we're targeting anybody who works with families, so it's a significant cross-sector effort. Each year we'll have Head Start represented, childcare, school-based programs, K-12. The symposium this year focusing on homelessness, we had Simpson Housing Services there, so they brought extra staff there to facilitate table discussions. So we're in alignment, trying to be in alignment with that needs assessment and helping support districts and doing a better job, being more proactive, identifying families that may need more support in their program, and then supporting staff to build capacity in order to better serve those families.
And Mr. Brown, we have a question for Representative Cotizzo-Batum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Brown, I'm just curious if you could clarify for the committee here. As far as we know, how many other states across the country offer this type of programming, or is Minnesota unique in providing ECFE across the state?
Mr. Brown.
Mr. Chair, thank you for the question. As far as I know, Minnesota is the only state that has a program unique to ECFE that requires licensed parent educators. In the sense that they have to get their license the same way that any other licensed teacher in Minnesota does. So I know there's other states that offer parenting education programming with children, so a two-generation type of programming, but I'm confident that Minnesota is the only state that has that licensed parent educator requirement.
Okay. And any other questions from members on ECFE? I'm not seeing any, so it looks like you're ready to move on to the next section, Mr. Brown. Or Ms. Burnham.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The school readiness program is really Minnesota's. It gets a little bit confusing because school readiness is a concept. But in Minnesota, it's a program. It's our oldest school-based preschool program. It serves children age 3, if they turn 3 by September 1st, and then up until kindergarten entrance. We serve about 20,000 children a year in school readiness. And the funding for the program is at $33.6 million. And again, this varies district by district. Some of our smaller districts, it can be as low as $5,000 or $6,000 in state funding, and then a larger district like Minneapolis is let me find my notes. I'll come back to it. I think they're at 2.4. Minneapolis is 2.4 million. Hendricks School District, 6,300. We collect data from them in annual report data, but we're aligning with other newer early childhood data systems. So our early education students, so we're making that transition into better data systems, better ways of reporting on the data. And I'll go into some of the key program components of school readiness. So as I mentioned, school readiness is Minnesota's first and most common public preschool program. All Minnesota school districts, so all 330 school districts, have a school readiness program. though you will find significant variability amongst school districts and how they design their school readiness program and what they offer. So part of that will go back to the funding. So you can imagine a school district like Hendricks that has $6,600 in school readiness funding is going to be more limited with what they can offer. There is another focus, a bigger focus on better alignment with K-12. One of those ways changes in Minnesota statutes is the requirement for the program plan to be incorporated into the district's world's best workforce plan. So each year when districts do their world's best workforce plan, they're supposed to incorporate school readiness program plan into that. And that's supposed to address how they're meeting the program requirements. Sorry for the small print on this page. These are the main program requirements of school readiness. So there's always a pre and a post assessment. So districts are supposed to assess children as they come into the program and before they exit the program. They have to provide comprehensive program content with instructional practices aligned to the state early childhood learning standards. So as Bobby mentioned, that would be Minnesota's ESIPs. School readiness programs are required to align there. Most curricula are advanced that they've already done the work and aligned to the state standards. There's strong language in there too about partnering with others. So programs are supposed to coordinate with kindergarten teachers and parents for transitions into kindergarten. They're supposed to involve parents in planning and decision making. They're supposed to coordinate with relevant community based services. Another opportunity is for them to cooperate with adult basic ed and adult literacy programs. So we'll see that some of our districts offer family literacy programs that will be a partnership between school readiness, adult basic ed, and early childhood family education. The eligibility for school readiness is 3 as of September 1st. They have to complete early childhood screening within 90 days of enrollment. And then they have to have one of the following risk factors. Most districts will qualify children based on whether or not they qualify for free and reduced lunch. But I just wanted to highlight the last one, which states that they may also be eligible if they're defined as at risk by the school district. So the alignment here with ECFE, the benefit for districts, if they're finding, for instance, in a district that has a high number of families who are deployed, a district could determine that's a risk factor and a child could be eligible for school readiness based on that.
Mr. Brown, we have a question from Representative Cotiza Watoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Brown, I just wanted to clarify again. So school readiness, like you mentioned, it's an idea and also a program here in the state of Minnesota. Does each district call their program school readiness, or is it just sort of a part of their preschool program offerings? There's so many programs that are available to parents, and myself, I have 3 children, 5 and under. It can be very confusing. I just want to make sure that people know what programs are available to them.
Mr. Brown.
Mr. Chair, thank you for the question. So I empathize with the confusion around that. I don't have specific data, but just working with all the school districts, it seems that it's rare that a district would call their preschool program a school readiness program. So we'll see a variation in names on what districts are calling their preschool program. And then when you add in the other program types, with voluntary pre-K and community ed preschools and stuff, it can likely be confusing.
Thank you.
Representative Fatis, we do.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So a parent could be unknowingly basically qualifying for, or their child could be qualifying for a school readiness program just by reaching out to the school district about the preschool opportunities.
Mr. Brown.
Mr. Chair, thank you for the question. I think I will address it a little bit more, so because it gets a little bit confusing on how districts set up their preschool program.
Okay. Okay. In that case, please continue.
So a district, this is the true for ECFE as well, but they must adopt a sliding fee schedule based on the family's income. If a family is unable to pay, they must waive the fee. Children who do not meet the eligibility requirements may participate on a fee-for-service basis. So this is the part where it may get confusing for not only for families, but for some districts, depending on how the program is set up. So ECFE and School Readiness are fund for programs. They go through the Community Services Fund as opposed to like voluntary pre-kindergarten or School Readiness Plus, which is a Fund 1 program, which that's the same fund that K-12 goes through. Within the Community Services Fund, districts can set up their program as a community ed preschool. And in those cases, they would use their school readiness funds or early learning scholarships, other funding to buy slots into that community ed preschool. So to the parent in that situation, that would just look like this is our district's preschool. And you may not even know what, as a parent, what school readiness is unless the district notified you based on eligibility. So during your, when a parent does their application or registers for the class, if there's a risk factor or if the parent expresses need for assistance with paying for the class, then they may qualify. Other districts run their entire program through school readiness. So all of the children are in school readiness. The only distinguishing factor there is that some children are meet those eligibility requirements. So they would be the three, the screening, and then they have a risk factor. And then the other children are paying on a fee-for-service basis. So they aren't eligible, but they're participating fee-for-service.
So, Mr. Brown, are you saying that if it goes through the community preschool approach, then one element is that then sliding fees can be charged based on income? I guess maybe I'll first ask that. Am I understanding that right?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. If in either case, though, they have to meet the school readiness program requirements. So wherever the school readiness money goes, that program has to meet school readiness program requirements. So if, for instance, if a school readiness program purchased slots, if they ran out of space and purchased slots in a local childcare program, that childcare program would have to meet the school readiness program requirements.
And sorry, I'm just getting a little bit confused. When I look at the risk factors on slide 26, some of these look like they would cause somebody, a family, to have difficulty paying that sliding fee. But I guess maybe the ones that don't, maybe a child has a individualized education program, but there's not an income situation, then the family may be paying a sliding fee based on income. Am I understanding that correctly?
Mr. Chair, can you say more? I just want to make sure I'm understanding.
Sorry, Mr. Brown. I'm just trying to understand how you're saying that the school readiness programs, for a child to be eligible, they have to meet one of the risk factors that the family does that are listed on slide 26. And also there's a sliding fee that can be charged based on income. And I'm just understanding, I guess, that some of these risk factors don't necessarily correlate to income. Am I understanding that correctly?
Oh, yeah, Mr. Chair. So, yeah, they may qualify for the program based on risk factors, but the fee schedule may or may not be relevant depending on the family situation and whether or not the family requests assistance paying for the class.
And did I hear correctly, Mr. Brown, that the same thing applies on slide 27, the sliding fee to ECFE as well? I don't think you mentioned that earlier, but just want to make sure I understood that.
Right, yes, correct, Mr. Chair. ECFE is required to have a sliding fee schedule as well and to waive the fee for any family that cannot afford to pay.
And then finally, just since it looks like you're about to wrap up with a school readiness only portion, are there capacity limitations right now in the funding for school readiness? I mean, I'm aware that there are districts that want to offer voluntary pre-K that haven't been able to. There's certainly scholarships, increased funding sought for scholarships for CCAP, for various programs. How does that correlate for school readiness? Is there a desire for more programs to be offered that is currently not being met?
Mr. Chair, thank you for the question. My understanding from working with the field is that there's a balance between quantity of children being served versus quantity of the time that they're able to provide services. So some districts with, especially when there's smaller amount of funding, may make the choice that we want to serve as many children as possible. However, our funding may limit us to one day a week. So in those cases, districts express a desire to be able to provide more intensive services that they would like to provide 3 or 4 or 5 day a week programming, but would be limited by funds or have to make the decision that they're going to serve much fewer children.
Okay. If you have information about that gap between, what districts are expressing as needed versus the current funding, I guess I'd be interested to at least have that information.
Mr. Chair, yeah, I would be happy to find that information and share it with the committee.
Thank you. And not seeing other questions for now, so please continue.
So a couple things I wanted to highlight for the committee is just the support, couple areas of support that MDE is focusing on with ECFE and school readiness. One area is technical assistance, guidance, and professional development and the creation of regional networking groups and practice committees. Another area is statewide and regional professional development, so partnerships with MNAFI, which is Minnesota Association of Family and Early Educators, that serves many school readiness and ECFE programs. The maps on this page highlight what we call our regional networking groups. They're based on the governor's economic development regions. You can see here there's more than 13. Some of the areas are geographically pretty spread out, so some we split. There's 25 total. Each region will have a facilitator or regional leader that's there volunteered. We work with each area to find somebody who will volunteer to serve in this role. It varies depending on the region. We have some regions that are pretty active, so they're meeting with other early childhood administrators every 6 weeks to 2 months discussing issues that are relevant to their programming. We have conference calls with the regional leads, webinars, with the intent of building that regional capacity so that they have local supports that they're able to rely on. We have two practice committees. I'll talk a little bit more about the Early Childhood Administration Practice Committee. So I'm sure many of you recognize how much early childhood's grown in the last couple of years, not only in importance, but in the complexity of the programming itself. So we recognize this, of course, as well. We have a group of metro area coordinators that come together every 6 weeks to discuss administration issues in early childhood programs. So it benefits them because we're able to bring in other people from the department to talk to the group. And it benefits the Department of Ed because we're able to hear firsthand from early childhood administrators what they're dealing with, what they're struggling with, what guidance and technical assistance that they need. And similar for Parenting Ed Practice Committee with people, of course, who are working with families and what they need in terms of professional development and guidance and ideas on how they can develop programming and services that better meet the needs of families.
Please continue.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I'm going to give a brief overview of the health and developmental screening program that the Department of Ed collaborates with our other agencies to implement. As you may know, the screening is a requirement, as Mike mentioned, for participation in the school readiness program, the voluntary pre-kindergarten program, and to receive a scholarship. The purpose of the Early Childhood and Health Developmental Screening Program is to assist parents and communities in improving the educational readiness and health of young children through early detection factors that may impede a children's learning, growth, and development. Eligibility requirement is children between the ages of 3 and kindergarten entrance, and of course our target age is the earlier the better. So the target age is between 3 and 4 years of age. We have a total number of 60,712 children who were screened in 2018. The state federal funding is on a reimbursement basis. It's remained fairly consistent over the last 10 years. It's now at $3.6 million, and in 2009 it was about $3.4 million. Unfortunately, districts report spending an additional $1.7 million to meet the required components of the health and developmental screening.
Ms. Burnham, did you mention federal funding in that? I thought I heard you say the word federal and was surprised, but I may have just misheard that.
Mr. Chair, I don't think I did.
Okay.
I shouldn't have if I did.
Thank you, Ms. Burnham.
State funding.
Just making sure.
Okay. Thank you.
Please continue.
Key program components include hearing, a vision and developmental screening, an immunization review, height and weight, identification of risk factors that may influence learning, health care coverage, parent interview process, and referral and follow-up when potential needs are identified. Of that, just over 60,000 children screened, 38% of all Minnesota 3-year-old children received health and developmental screening. Referrals for further assistance made were for 14,774 children were identified as having possible health and developmental problems through the screening process.
And we've got a question for Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just again, to clarify my understanding of this, so this is screening that's state-funded, but do we have data from, I mean, if you have insurance and you take your three-year-old to the doctor, isn't there screening there too? And when we only say 38% of children are screened, are we including the ones that might be screened through other routine doctor visits?
Ms. Burnham.
Mr. Chair, that's a great question, and I'll get into a little bit of that. But unfortunately, we don't have the authority to collect data from all the different types of programs, so there may be some duplication that occurs. We're trying to determine a way to not have so much duplication in screening by partnering with more medical institutions and early well-being visits. And so it's just a matter of not being able to share that data at this point.
Thank you. Please continue.
So the support that we provide for the screening, health and developmental screening program in our districts includes both in-person full-day sessions 3 times a year statewide, as well as online training modules. The topics that we include in the technical assistance that we provide includes equitable outreach to diverse populations, program administration, leadership, and continuous quality improvement, developmental and social-emotional screening, and effective follow-up on referrals, and the support of dual language learners in screening. So interpreters are also a challenge. They are used whenever possible to serve our dual language learners. Capacity for training is limited. The staff person on my team is 0.5 FTE, so there's only so much he can do in that half-time capacity. So school districts are required to do outreach, and some of the strategies that districts use for outreach to reach those families to get screened includes videos and brochures for parents in multiple languages, the hiring of diverse staff where possible, interpreters where possible, and collaborations across different program types to reach all the children. Outreach and screen in multiple locations most accessible to families, including libraries, child care centers, homeless shelters, public housing, faith-based locations, or community centers. Again, doing screening on the not-so-normal times of evenings and weekends, and sending letters or postcards to each resident and advertise in local communities through newspapers, ethnic radio, cable television, websites, community events, or other meeting types. So districts really do work hard for outreach to reach those families and children to get them screened at an early age. So in Minnesota, we have a Minnesota Interagency Early Childhood Screening Task Force. And the vision of this task force is, of course, to get all children in Minnesota screened between the ages of birth and 5. Excuse me. So this task force is a task force that is composed of multiple members across the different agencies. And included in this task force are support the following public programs that provide health and developmental screening. So you may be aware that MDE is just one agency that provides screening. Screening happens through the Department of Health and through programs offered by the Department of Human Services. Those include child and teen checkups, clinics and providers, early childhood screening, Head Start and early Head Start, local public health screening programs, family home visiting, follow-along program, adult and early childhood mental health providers, child welfare. So a number of these programs offer screening. And as I mentioned earlier, the challenge is to coordinate to ensure that duplication doesn't occur. And the challenge there is our ability to share data with one another. So as you will hear Thursday, one of the Office of the Legislator Auditor recommendation is to figure out how to better share data. So we are trying to do that. That is a core priority of the preschool development grant, which you will also hear about Thursday. So we will share a little bit about our strategies that we hope to promote more ease of sharing data across state agencies.
Ms. Burnham, can I just clarify, building on Representative Cortese Witun's question, though, so is this, can see if it is a task force. Is its jurisdiction, does it encompass the health and wellness screenings that are happening in pediatrics, in medical settings as well? Is that included in the work of this task force?
Mr. Chair, I believe so. Okay. Yes, so we are trying to really do a more intentional collaboration across the agencies around screening and to get our programs coordinated and the data coordinated so there isn't duplication and we are able to see who is screened where and for what.
I will just note, Ms. Burnham, my understanding is that the percentage of kids who have those sorts of screenings is significantly higher than the 38%, and of course they start a lot earlier too, which is has a big advantage, as we've been hearing about in the committee. So I'm glad to hear that that's taking a holistic look. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Please continue.
So the Minnesota Interagency Early Childhood Screening Task Force is the team that really does the research and promotes the research-based screening tools. So for a tool to be on the approved list as a research-based screening tool, it goes through a review criteria. And the review criteria is based on nationally accepted psychometric standards, developmental and social-emotional screening instruments that sufficiently meet criteria outlined below are considered for recommendation and approval. And that criteria includes instrument purpose, the developmental domains, of course, reliability and validity, and the recent standardization. In addition, additional considerations also include practicality, population and age span, cultural and ethnic and linguistic sensitivity, and the minimum expertise of screeners, and of course, the cost.
Not seeing any questions, please continue to the KEP.
So, thank you, Mr. Chair. The kindergarten entry profile, as I mentioned last week, the kindergarten entry profile, of course, is a piece of that P3 comprehensive assessment system that we worked on developing as part of our Race to the Top work. The kindergarten entry profile is certainly a key component. And today we're going to talk about what the kindergarten entry profile is and as important, what it is not. So the Kindergarten Entry Profile Initiative is a voluntary standards-based assessment system that supports the use of high-quality, comprehensive, and developmentally appropriate assessment tools whose purpose is to help teachers and administrators understand what students know and are able to do at the start of kindergarten to support their success in school and beyond. So a little bit of history. You may have heard of the School Readiness Study, which was the prior name to the kindergarten entry profile. So 5 years ago, again, part of the Race to the Top, we received the grant to pilot a standards-based assessment system. The system is based on the latest research in child development, assessment, and brain development. And the goal was really to, again, like I mentioned earlier, develop a comprehensive pre-K through third grade assessment system so it could be used across all program and setting types for all children. This is a history of the school readiness study / KEP participation. It's important to note that participating in the KEP, which was the school readiness study, is on a voluntary basis. So school districts are not required to participate in the school readiness study, now known as the KEP. Therefore, participation numbers are very low. And you can see across the years that participation has fluctuated across the years. Some years are higher, and that was due to participating in the pilot during the Race to the Top years, to the 2017-2018 year where we just had over a 7% participation rate. And I'll talk about this in a little bit, but 7% is not a representative sampling of the kindergartners in our state. So that's why we do not use this data to show the percentage of children who are ready for kindergarten. All the kindergarten entry approved assessment tools are valid and reliable to use with kindergarten children, are aligned to the ESIPs and the Minnesota academic standards, represent a whole child view of development and education, meaning they cover all 8 domains. They provide real-time formative data that can be used to individualize instruction and they rely on authentic assessment, which is more accessible and appropriate for culturally and linguistically and developmentally diverse children, including children with disabilities. So authentic assessment does not require changes to the instructional day or the curriculum. Authentic assessment is implemented during the day through an observation-based system or protocol.
Ms. Burnham, we've got a question from Representative Wasilewicz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Burnham, I'm wondering if you can just briefly talk about, I kind of remember what they mean, but if you could talk about, for the committee's sake, what you mean by validity and reliability. I think that's an important piece of this. When we're talking about these tools, if you could elaborate on a little bit on what those terms mean.
Ms. Burnham.
Mr. Chair, that's a great question, and I'll do my best to answer it. And Mike, if you could help me, that would be great. So my understanding is it's really based on a extensive research study. So phase one of the study was to determine which tools are most widely used in the state of Minnesota to address kindergarten readiness. We took those eight tools and aligned them to the standards, and there were four tools that stood out that were more deeply aligned to the standards than the other eight. So then we took those four tools and aligned them to each other. So that was phase two of the research study. So then when we were able to collect data, we knew we could compare apples to apples. So if one district implemented the TS Gold and another district implemented the DRDP, the alignment we did between the four tools gave us the same information. So that was a four-year process.
And Ms. Burnham, just want to make sure I'm understanding. So you've got the ESIPs that say what children should know at different ages and stages, and then this is then assessing that at that kindergarten stage, how do they match up to this? Is that essentially what's going on here?
Mr. Chair, that is exactly what the kindergarten entry profile is designed to do.
Okay, good. All right. Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it's an assessment program, and is it to help identify specific something about the child or about the program that the child is entered in?
Ms. Burnham.
Mr. Chair, it's a child assessment. So it's typically given between the first 8 to 10 weeks of the kindergarten year. And it's really the main purpose is to help the kindergarten teacher know the type of instruction that that individual child needs at that time.
Okay, please continue.
So back to the idea of around authentic assessment. So back when I even taught kindergarten 30 years ago, I would pull kids out in the hallway, send them at desk, and flash cards to them, and that's how I was even assessed in kindergarten. That is not authentic assessment, and that is not what the KEP is. So the KEP is observation-based. It occurs within the educational routine, through centers, through whole group instruction, through recess, through music. So it's really the teacher is observing her children at all times during the instructional day. It can include work samples, videos, photographs. It's conducted over time. It incorporates verbal and nonverbal responses. So authentic assessments do not rely on direct one-to-one assessment, a question and answer, only verbal or written response, or one moment in time answers. The three approved tools on the KEP menu are the desired results developmental profile, which we call the DRDP. This is one of the assessments that is free, and the Pearson Work Sampling System and the Teaching Strategies Gold. Currently, the Division of Early Learning Services is partnering with our early childhood special ed partners and our scholarship partners in building a system to collect multiple data points, and the KEP is one of those data points. And so eventually, we will be able to produce reports that we provide back to individual teachers on their classrooms about the types of learnings that they may need to focus more on or less on. So this is just an example of a report that we are working as a prototype to produce for districts. So it's part of that feedback loop that is new for the KEP. So just as important as it is for us to receive the data, it's more important for the teachers to receive the input back and the data back to help inform their instruction. Again, due to the voluntary nature of the current kindergarten entry profile, the results that we're getting are not representative of a sampling across the state. So therefore, we can't make generalizations of a percent of kindergartners who are kindergarten ready. This is just a visual that really shows the intentional work of this piece of our comprehensive assessment system. Across the top are all the different program types that we are promoting the use of a KEP tool and how that use of the KEP tool is informing World's Best Workforce reporting, the early childhood special ed outcome summary, COSIF reporting, as well as the Read Well by Third Grade reporting for part of that World's Best Workforce.
And Ms. Burnham, is the data actually being used in that way? I mean, it's been in place for a couple of years, although I know a relatively small percentage of children participating are districts, but I mean, are there examples of where this is actually being used?
Mr. Chair, that's a great question, and I'm happy to inform that myself and my staff have been reviewing World's Best Workforce plans, and the difference between what we were reading 3 years ago to what we were reading this year is night and day. So we can happily say that the work we are doing with the guidance around the KEP and using these valid and reliable tools is paying off, because a lot of the school readiness goals in the World's Best Workforce summaries are showing that they are using these tools and using the data to help inform their instruction.
And I know, Ms. Burnham, that the percentage of kindergartners using it dropped quite a bit from the last school year to this school year. Do you have a sense that, I guess I'm wondering if you have a sense as to why that is, but also if you have a sense that, is it climbing back up? Do you expect there to be a greater percentage of kids in districts using the tool? If it is, in fact, as useful as you describe, just give us a sense of that.
Mr. Chair, yes, I believe that the number of districts using one of these tools is increasing, basically due to the requirement in VPK and School Readiness Plus that they choose one of these tools and provide us the exit and entry data that's required in those statutes. As we continue, even though the budget for the KEP is $281,000, so that doesn't provide us a lot of leeway to incentivize districts to participate in the actual kindergarten entry profile. So we're really working with our VPK sites who are using one of these tools, who are also using it in their kindergarten. So our goal, of course, is for districts to choose one of these tools and eventually use it pre-K, potentially even through third grade. But right now we're focusing on that pre-K to K transition and use of the same tool across that age span.
Okay, and I'm wondering, as I'm looking at this, maybe part of the reason the numbers dropped this school year is because we're still in the middle of the school year, perhaps. I don't know if that would, of course, I guess kids would get assessed at the beginning of the year, wouldn't they? I'm just wondering if you have a sense as to why the numbers appear to have gone down this year compared to last school year.
Mr. Chair, again, it's hard to say. The main reason being it's for the KEP to give this in the first 8 to 10 weeks of kindergarten is totally voluntary.
Right.
So the more we are providing reports back and incentivizing districts and showing them that this makes better sense, those numbers will slowly grow back. But
okay.
As long as it's voluntary, we aren't going to get a good, solid representation.
Okay. Thank you. Please continue.
So again, just to outline the basics of the KEP, Participation is voluntary. Participants would select one of the three KEP-approved assessment tools. MDE does cover the cost of the assessment, which is typically between $5 and $11. That goes towards a subscription to the online version of the tools to ease administrative procedures for teachers. Teachers attend a free 1 to 2 day training, and we also encourage principals and early learning administrators to attend as well. Teachers document data on their students during the first 8 to 10 weeks of school. Administrators provide MDE with their fall data, and MDE provides participants with a profile that shows what portion of students are meeting or exceeding age expectations. So just a few to end this set of slides around the benefits of using a metric like a KEP assessment. It provides teachers and other educators with a holistic view of a child's strengths and areas of growth based on their own unique identities, experiences, and development to individualize instruction, including those kids with IEPs. So it's emphasizing a well-rounded education. It informs practice and programming, including lesson planning, curriculum, resources, support, even professional development. And it builds coherence across that pre-K through third grade teaching and learning, strengthening that transition piece to kindergarten, as well as the professional development that we encourage between pre-K and kindergarten teachers. And it really guides efforts to close the achievement gap or prevent one from even happening or opening by reporting on district and charter schools' world's best workforce goal number one for all children to be ready for school. So how not to use the kindergarten entry profile data is to determine whether a student should start kindergarten or not, or to make high-stakes decisions about children, teachers, or programs. And this just briefly, I wanted to highlight some of the work we are doing, again, on that pre-K through third grade learning continuum. Mike and I, over the past 6 to 8 years, have really been focused on promoting this idea around this pre-K through third grade implementation, and we really work with professional organizations, the Elementary School Principals Association, the Superintendents Association, and promote this message of it's all everyone's responsibility, not just when those kids enter your kindergarten classroom. So it's really working with elementary school principals to build their capacity around child development and brain science, and to help them promote a better relationship and a stronger partnership with their early childhood partners in their community, their Head Start partners. So for the first phase of this work, we used some Race to the Top funding and a grant we received from McKnight to promote three different learning sessions, one based on leadership capacity, the second one being based on building rigorous and robust learning environments, so that's educator capacity. And then the third series was really based on building a coherent system.
Representative Franson has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Burham, so on the page 27, on the how not to use KEP data, there is an X mark by the to make high stakes decisions about children, teachers, or programs. So my question to you then is, what measure do you use then to measure the effectiveness of the programs to see if they're actually working?
Ms. Burnham.
Mr. Chair, that's a great question. Thank you. I think you use a multitude of measures. You look at, this is one metric that can be used. You can use screening, you can use home visiting data, screening data. So it's a combination of metrics that really determine the effectiveness of a program. So the KEP and the if we were to get a statewide sampling, it would certainly help us define what programs, what program qualities are more impactful than others. So program quality is not really based on one measure in the KEP. It's based on intensity and duration. There's multiple program factors that can determine the impact of a given program. Teacher qualifications, duration, alignment to curriculum, parent education.
All right, well,
thank you. Yep,
yeah, thank you. So basically, there is really no set standard. So,
Ms. Burnham.
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure what you mean by set standard. So there is no one metric that we use to measure program impact.
Representative Franson.
Thank you.
Okay. And I actually have a question on the next slide, or maybe it's, I guess it is the next slide. Just the number served, am I reading this right then, that like it's about 1,100 people served, of which 230 are principals, and I assume that the rest are teachers, I'm guessing, and then they represent a total of, you know, 230 some districts. Am I reading that line right?
Mr. Brown. Mr. Chair, that's correct. So the all of our series required teams to participate, and those teams could be made up of principals, superintendents, community ed directors, other district or community partners. So the 1,078 is the total number that participated.
Okay. And we've got about 60 seconds left. It looks like you got the one more slide. So.
and just, Mr. Chair, thank you. This is just to talk about phase two. So our Race to the Top and McKnight money ran out. So we lobbied for some Title II money, federal Title II money that's focused on leadership, principal leadership. So we are implementing regional learning opportunities to kind of build on our phase one work. So we're offering, how many regions?
Six.
In six regions with a three-day opportunity focused on elements of high-performing pre-K systems, teaching and instructional quality, and blending and braiding, maximizing your federal and state funding.
Thank you very much. We'll have to defer questions to another time. Members on, and members certainly should feel free to contact these folks. On Thursday, we're going to be stepping back from these individual programs and getting an update from the Office of Legislative Auditor on the report that they had from last spring, kind of how the different programs are put together and some background as well. So with that, we are adjourned.